Hello, and welcome to Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. It's June 19th, 2016. It was on this day in 1991 that the Soviet occupation of Hungary came to an end. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto tells us about the experiences of a college student from Spain who is attending the University of Alabama. Then, Ana Mateo will be with us, as she is every Sunday, with Words and Their Stories. This week, she will tell us about American English expressions using the word neck. And as we always do on the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we take you back to the 1920s, a time when Americans experimented with many new customs and social traditions. But it was also a conservative time in American life. So, you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Now, as we do every Sunday, we tell you what is happening in American higher education. This week, we continue our new ongoing series about international students who are studying at colleges and universities across the United States. Here is correspondent Pete Musto.
Pablo Ramos is from Spain. He says friends studying at Spanish universities tell him their experiences are very limited.
Their college experience is basically just going to class. Everything after that is just extra and it's completely up to them.
Ramos thought he too would be limited to the normal experience of a Spanish university. But just before his last year of high school in Ibiza, a friend of Ramos's family suggested that he finish high school in the United States. In 2013, Ramos attended St. Andrew's Sewanee School in Sewanee, Tennessee. He had the help of a scholarship from an organization called American Secondary Schools for International Students and Teachers. While studying at St. Andrew's, Ramos became friends with the son of the Dean of Engineering at a university just a few hours away. That university was the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Founded in 1831, this university of over 37,000 students is known for many things. It is the oldest public university in Alabama. Northern troops burned down the original campus during the American Civil War. The campus has an American football stadium that can fit over 101,000 people, and the football team has won 16 national college championships. The University of Alabama also has a troubled history of dealing with discrimination. It was at the center of the civil rights movement. Authorine Lucy was the first African-American student to attend the school in 1953. She was forced to leave the school after only 3 days because of threats made against her. Former Alabama Governor George Wallace famously tried to prevent two more African American students from attending in 1963. But Wallace was unsuccessful, and the school began to accept students of all races. Some of Ramos's friends thought he must be insane to go to school in Alabama. Yet, this did not stop him from starting an undergraduate degree in chemical engineering there in 2014. Yilin Wang from Beijing, China, started her undergraduate degree in psychology at the University of Alabama in 2013. Both had difficulty making friends when they first arrived. They say that it was only after they began to explore extracurricular options that they began to make lasting friendships. Wang has always loved the Japanese style of animated movies and television called anime. After doing some research, Wang found a student group called the Bama SOS Brigade. The group brings students who love anime, comic books, and other similar media together to discuss their interests. She also joined the Subcommittee on Diversity and Inclusion, a group of students, professors, and staff, in early 2016. The group works to make the school a more welcoming place for all people. Joining this group has taught her a lot, Wang says.
I really learned a lot about how people think about diversity and how important diversity is. It's all about start the conversation in the right way so that people understand each other.
Ramos was immediately interested when he learned of a group called the Student Government Association, or SGA. The SGA members work with the school's administration to plan events and programs, as well as make rules for students to follow. Ramos has now been elected as a member of the SGA Senate and hopes to get other students more involved. He has made many friends through his involvement. He says he is considering a future in politics.
The chance to participate in campus politics or be part of organizations or be able to create your own or do research as an undergrad, those are things that people in Spain don't even think about at all, but people here take for granted.
Other than football, the most popular extracurricular activity is Greek life. Greek life is the name for the collection of fraternities and sororities at any university. These are private social clubs that students can attempt to join. These organizations use letters from the Greek alphabet as their names. If one of these organizations accepts a student, they must pay to be a member. Members often live together in a house. They form powerful social networks that last a lifetime. They often help their brothers and sisters find jobs after college. Wang says Greek life members are often not very friendly to non-members. They are also sometimes known for bad behavior involving alcohol. In some fraternities and sororities, new members must do whatever an old member tells them to show their loyalty. The University of Alabama has some of the most active Greek life in the country. Over 33% of all the school's undergraduates are involved in 61 different Greek life organizations. At times, there can be divisions between the school's Greek and non-Greek students. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete. Pete and I hope you'll join us every Sunday over the next several weeks as he brings you stories about international students and their experiences at American colleges and universities. Now, words and their stories. One of our most popular programs. Today, how a common body part, the neck, is used in many expressions heard daily in America.
A pain in the neck is a common complaint. The neck muscles hurt. Turning the head from left to right is difficult. Even the smallest movement becomes painful. No matter how it got that way, a sore neck hurts. Pain in the neck is also a common expression in American English. We use this expression to describe something or someone who gives you an irritated, uncomfortable feeling. You know, like the couple that comes into a movie theater late. While the important first few minutes of the movie play, they step over everyone to get to the only seats available in the middle of the row. They take off their coats and bags, blocking people's view of the movie screen. Then, as they eat popcorn loudly, they begin talking. "This movie better be as good as the book," one says. "I know," says the other. "We paid a lot for these tickets." "And so did everybody else." And the audience wants to enjoy the movie, not listen to these two pains in the neck. This expression is not only used for people. Certain activities and events can be a pain in the neck. For some, washing the dishes is a pain in the neck. Maybe for you, attending long, boring meetings at work is a pain in the neck. For me, remembering all my passwords is a pain in the neck. But let's get back to annoying people. Annoying people can make us angry, so angry that we may want to wring their necks. This is a common threat to say when we are angry at someone, as in this example. "She stole my idea for a book. I could just wring her scrawny little neck." Sometimes we take the time to describe the neck we want to wring. There are many types of annoying people whose neck you may want to wring, especially annoying people on the road. Let's say you are driving along a highway. Traffic is moving quickly at first. Then cars start slowing down, almost to a standstill. You wonder what could be causing the delay. Then you see it. An accident on the other side of the road. The cars involved have been pulled away. All that is left is some broken glass, parts of some cars, and two police officers. The problem now is that people are slowing down to stare, to rubberneck. Rubberneckers look at the damage from the accident instead of the road. They drive slowly and cause traffic delays. Rubberneckers and traffic delays are both pains in the neck. Sometimes when a person rubbernecks, he is actually sticking his neck out of the car window. But doing that is different from the idiomatic phrase, to stick your neck out. To stick your neck out has several meanings. It means to take a chance or a risk. You can stick your neck out by investing a lot of money in a risky business deal. To stick your neck out also means to put yourself at risk for someone else. For example, you could say, "Look, I really stuck my neck out for you. I could lose my job because I lied for you." This phrase also means to give an opinion that other people may not like or that other people are scared to give. For example, she really stuck her neck out at the meeting for saying what she did. Her views may not be politically popular, but they do make sense. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. You are now officially up to your neck in neck expressions. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now, as we do every Sunday, we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, we take you back to the 1920s, a time when Americans experimented with many new customs and social traditions. There were new dances, new kinds of clothes, and some of the most imaginative art and writing ever produced up until that time in the United States. But in most ways, the 1920s were a conservative time in American life. Voters elected three conservative Republican presidents, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover. And they supported many conservative social and political policies. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of American conservatism during the 1920s.
One such policy concerned immigration. Most Americans in the 1920s had at least some ties through blood or marriage to the first Americans who came from Britain. Many people with these kinds of historic ties considered themselves to be real Americans, true Americans. Americans traditionally had welcomed newcomers from such Western European countries as Britain, France, or Germany. But most of the people arriving in New York City and other harbors in the 1920s were from the central, eastern, and southern areas of Europe. Some Americans became afraid of these millions of people arriving at their shores. They worried that the immigrant newcomers might steal their jobs, or they feared the political beliefs of the immigrants.
Pressure to control immigration increased following the World War. Congress passed a bill that set a limit on how many people would be allowed to enter from each foreign country. And the Congress and President Calvin Coolidge agreed to an even stronger immigration law in 1924. Under the new law, limits on the number of immigrants from each foreign country depended on the number of Americans who had families in that country. For example, the law allowed many immigrants to enter from Britain or France because many American citizens had families in those countries. But fewer people could come from Italy or Russia because fewer Americans had family members in those countries. The laws were very difficult to enforce, but they did succeed in limiting the number of immigrants from certain countries.
A second sign of the conservative feelings in the 1920s was the nation's effort to ban the sale of alcoholic drinks or liquor. This policy was known as prohibition because it prohibited or banned alcoholic drinks. Many of the strongest supporters of prohibition were conservative Americans living in rural areas. Many of them believed that liquor was evil, the product of the devil. A number of towns and states passed laws banning alcohol sales during the first years of the 20th century. And in 1919, the nation passed the 18th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. This amendment and the Volstead Act made it unlawful to make, sell, or transport liquor.
Prohibition laws failed terribly from the start. There was only a small force of police to enforce the new laws, and millions of Americans still wanted to drink liquor. It was not possible for the police to watch every American who wanted to buy a drink secretly or make liquor in his own home. Not surprisingly, thousands of Americans soon saw a chance to make profits from the new laws. They began to import liquor illegally to sell for high prices. Criminals began to bring liquor across the long, unprotected border with Canada, or on fast boats from the Caribbean islands. At the same time, private manufacturers in both cities and rural areas began to produce liquor, and shop owners in cities across the country sold liquor with little interference from local police. By the middle of the 1920s, it was clear to most Americans that prohibition laws were a failure. But the laws were not changed until the election of President Franklin Roosevelt in 1932.
A third sign of conservatism in the 1920s was the effort by some Americans to ban school books on modern science. Most of the Americans who supported these efforts were conservative rural Americans who believed in the traditional ideas of the Protestant Christian Church. Many of them were fearful of the many changes that had taken place in American society. Science became an enemy to many of these traditional religious Americans. Science seemed to challenge the most basic ideas taught in the Bible. The conflict burst into a major public debate in 1925 in a trial over Charles Darwin's idea of evolution.
British scientist Charles Darwin published his books, The Origin of the Species and The Descent of Man, in the 19th century. The books explained Darwin's idea that humans developed over millions of years from apes and other animals. Most Europeans and educated people accepted Darwin's theory by the end of the 19th century. But the book had little effect in rural parts of the United States until the 1920s. William Jennings Bryan led the attack on Darwin's ideas. Bryan was a rural Democrat who ran twice for president. He lost both times. But Bryan remained popular among many traditional Americans. Bryan told his followers that the theory of evolution was evil because it challenged the traditional idea that God created the world in 6 days. He accused scientists of violating God's words in the Bible. Bryan and his supporters called on local school officials to ban the teaching of evolution. Some state legislatures in the more conservative southeastern part of the country passed laws making it a crime to teach evolution theory.
In 1925, a young science teacher in the southern state of Tennessee challenged the state's new teaching law. The teacher, John Scopes, taught Darwin's evolution ideas. Officials arrested Scopes and put him on trial. Some of the nation's greatest lawyers rushed to Tennessee to defend the young teacher. They believed the state had violated his right to free speech, and they thought Tennessee's law against teaching evolution was foolish in a modern scientific society. America's most famous lawyer, Clarence Darrow, became the leader of Scopes' defense team. Bryan and other religious conservatives also rushed to the trial. They supported the right of the state of Tennessee to ban the teaching of evolution. The trial was held in the small town of Dayton, Tennessee. Hundreds of people came to watch. Religious conservatives, free speech supporters, newsmen, and others. The high point of the trial came when Brian himself sat before the court. Lawyer Clarence Darrow asked Brian question after question about the Bible and about science. How did Brian know the Bible is true? Did God really create the earth in a single day? Is a day in the Bible 24 hours, or can it mean a million years?
Brian answered the questions, but he showed a great lack of knowledge about modern science. The judge found Scopes guilty of breaking the law. But in the battle of ideas, science defeated conservatism. And a higher court later ruled that Scopes was not guilty. The Scopes evolution trial captured the imagination of Americans. The issue was not really whether one young teacher was innocent or guilty of breaking a law. The real question was the struggle for America's spirit between the forces of modern ideas and those of traditional rural conservatism. The trial represented this larger conflict.
American society was changing in many important ways during the early part of the 20th century. The United States was not yet the world superpower that it would become after World War II. But neither was it a traditional rural society of conservative farmers and clergy. The 1920s were a period of growth, change, and struggle between old and new values. The early years of the 20th century were a time of movement for many black Americans. Traditionally, most blacks lived in the southeastern states. But in the 1920s, many blacks moved to cities in the north. They did so because living conditions were so poor in the rural areas of the southeast. But many of them discovered that life was also hard in the colder northern cities. Jobs often were hard to find. Housing was poor, and whites sometimes acted violently against them. We will tell the story of black migration on our Making of a Nation program next week on Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to all of the stories that you have just heard on this program. Well, that's Learning English Weekend, the Sunday edition. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. Jonathan Evans will be here tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with As It Is Monday, the weekday Learning English broadcast, webcast, and podcast from The Voice of America.